From the studios of Kootenai Co-op Radio, this is Deconstructing Dinner.
A recent Environmental Protection Agency report said that there are now 36 states in the United States that are going to have, and I quote, from severe to serious to severe water crises. But in Arizona, they just announced that they're building a water theme park in the desert called the Water Wave. It reminds me of the Far Side cartoon where there's a bunch of dogs in a life raft, and their ship is sinking, so that's why they're in this life raft. And one of them says, okay, everybody who wants to eat all the food at once, put your hands up, right? It's like, okay, we have 10 years left of water. Maybe if we build a water theme park, we can knock that down to 5, you know?
And you're tuned in to Deconstructing Dinner, a weekly one-hour radio show and podcast produced at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY, in Nelson, British Columbia. I'm John Steinman, your host for the next hour. On today's broadcast, we will hear from two distinguished Canadians, both of whom are recipients of the Right Livelihood Award, also known as the Alternative Nobel. In the first part of the show, we feature some breaking news out of Saskatchewan involving perhaps the most well-known farmer in Canada, Percy Schmeiser, who spent between 1998 and 2004 standing up to one of the most influential agricultural companies in the world, Monsanto. While it was Monsanto that took Schmeiser to court on that occasion, on Wednesday, March 19, 2008, the roles were reversed, and Monsanto found itself being taken to court by Schmeiser. And taking up the larger part of today's broadcast, we listen in on segments from one of the more well-known figures fighting for the democratic rights of Canadians, Maude Barlow, the national chairperson for the Council of Canadians. Through her Blue Planet project, Barlow has been internationally advocating on the right to water. Just as water is the blood of the earth, so too is it the foundation of our food and agricultural systems, let alone a necessary component of any good meal. But the current and future state of water, as we'll hear, Barlow suggests, is the greatest ecological and human rights crisis of our time. In March 2008, she spoke to a sold-out audience in Castlegar, British Columbia, and Deconstructing Dinner was on hand to record the event.
Deconstructing Dinner is made possible by the generous support from the G. Raymond Chang School of Continuing Education Certificate in Food Security at Ryerson University. The Chang School offers you food for thought in your exploration of food issues and impacts, including urban agriculture. For more information about this unique distance education program, visit ryerson.ca/CE/food security.
If you miss any of today's show featuring Percy Schmeiser and Maude Barlow, it will be archived on our website at cjly.net/deconstructingdinner. And as usual, there will be a page posted on the TIE website where responses to the show can be posted online. And that website is at the TIE.ca. Also, one quick announcement before we move on to today's broadcast. Deconstructing Dinner is putting out a call for volunteers to help us with a project that we consider to be of great importance. And the goal behind the project is to have all broadcasts that have aired since January 2006 transcribed into print so that this information can then be accessible both in audio and visual format. So what we're asking is for anyone interested in donating some time transcribing broadcasts to get in touch with us, send us an email at deconstructingdinner@cjly.net and let us know if you're interested to help out. There is more detailed information on this project along with some already completed transcripts posted on our website. And again, our email is deconstructingdinner@cjly.net. And on to the breaking news. As of March 19th, 2008, in an out-of-court settlement in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, agricultural giant Monsanto has agreed to pay farmer Percy Schmeiser the $660 that it cost him to clean up the contamination of his farm by the company's product in 2005. While not a legal precedent, Schmeiser considers and believes that this case has led to a more public admission by the company that they are willing to accept the liability for the damage their plants cause other farmers. He also believes it will encourage other farmers to do the same. In just a moment, we'll listen in on an interview recorded by the one person from the media who was at the courthouse on March 19th. But first, let's look at the history of this case. Monsanto has been a recent feature here on the program following our multi-part series back in January titled The Colonization of the Canadian Farmer. That series shared the evolution of yet another legal battle that had been launched by organic farmers in Saskatchewan wishing to seek class action status against Monsanto and another influential agricultural player, Bayer. But for most who know Monsanto, it was the original case with Percy Schmeiser that began in 1997 that not only exposed the company more than they probably would have liked, but that also led to Schmeiser receiving international recognition for the way in which he stood up to the company's aggressive tactics. It was also this case that led to Schmeiser and his wife Louise receiving the Distinguished Right Livelihood Award in December 2007. The award is often referred to as the Alternative Nobel. Schmeiser has become such a recognized name around the world because his efforts are directly involving the controversial genetic modification and corporate control of seeds and of food. Companies like Monsanto have used the process of genetically modifying plant varieties in order to be able to patent the plant and assume greater control over who uses it, how it's grown, and how it's sold. For those unfamiliar with the first Schmeiser case, it was in 1997 that Monsanto hired a company to trespass onto Schmeiser's farm and take samples. The company had believed that Schmeiser was growing their patented Roundup Ready variety of canola without a license to do so. Following testing by the company, it was determined that in 1998, Schmeiser had, through the seeds he saved from 1997, planted Roundup Ready canola on his farm. Monsanto demanded Schmeiser pay up, and Schmeiser refused as he had argued that his fields were contaminated through uncontrollable circumstances, also known as nature, and he should maintain the right to save his seed and plant it again the following year. I caught up with Percy Schmeiser over the phone. He spoke to me from his home in Bruno, Saskatchewan, and he recalled what happened next.
They took me to court because they said we were using their GMO canola without a license from them, even though they had contaminated us against our wishes, and they said because under patent law they have a patent on that gene, doesn't matter how it gets into any farmer's seeds, plants, or any gardener seeds or plants, they own and control that life form, and they said we ought should have known they had contaminated us, and therefore we should not have used our own seeds, which we had been doing for 50 years because we were doing research in new development of seeds and plants in canola. So basically, a farmer could wake up tomorrow morning, whether he's an organic farmer, conventional farmer, no longer have control or own his seeds or plants, are not allowed to use his seeds or plants again because they belong to a corporation, in this case, Monsanto.
Now, it was this case that led to the final 2004 Supreme Court decision that technically ruled in favor of Monsanto. However, Schmeiser was not ordered to pay any of Monsanto's legal costs. While the Supreme Court decision assured that regardless of contamination, a farmer cannot grow patented seeds, Schmeiser recognized that if the company is indeed the owner of the plant, then they should be liable for the damages that their property causes others. The opportunity to test such liability came in October 2005 when Schmeiser's farm was visited yet again by Monsanto, and again in the form of their Roundup Ready canola.
Yes, it happened in the October of 2005. We were preparing some land to develop and new varieties of yellow mustard, and we grew no crop on 50 acres on this particular piece to get weed control and also and not use any chemicals on it. So what happened in October, we noticed there were canola plants growing where there should have been nothing growing on it, and we did some testing. We found that it did not die when we sprayed on the leaves of 10 plants. We staked out 10 plants, did not die after being sprayed with Roundup, Monsanto's chemical herbicide Roundup. We notified Monsanto, and indeed, within a couple of days or 3 or 4 days, they came and did testing and found out and verified it by a letter to us that it was their Roundup Ready canola plants grown on our land. And there had been no canola grown on that land for many, many years, at least for 8 years. They asked us what we wanted to have done, and we said we wanted the plants to be removed because you cannot separate mustard and canola. And they agreed to do that, but then all of a sudden they came back to us and they said before they would do that, we have to sign a release document that we could never take them to court again for the rest of our life, no matter how much they contaminated that land in the future. And also a gag order that we could not talk to the press or to neighbor what the terms of settlement was. And we said, no way would we ever give our freedom of speech away. So they refused to remove it unless we sign the documents. And so then we said, finally, we're going to remove the plants, which we did. And then we sent the bill to Monsanto. They refused to pay it because they said that we didn't agree to their terms and conditions. And we told them, you have your property on our property. You're trespassing. You're violating our rights. And we want it out of here. So when they didn't pay, finally we sent them a bill. They didn't pay it. And then we took them to court. Now it has become basically a very important case to them because it's a liability issue. And so that's why it's being watched closely, I think, not only here in Canada, but all over the world. Because if we win, it could cost Monsanto hundreds of millions of dollars around the world on the liability issue.
Now, it's this that will form the basis for an upcoming show, perhaps even as early as next week, while the necessary information is gathered. Because as many of us living in cities and even many farmers would likely not know, Monsanto has accepted liability for the damages their plants cause others, just not legally, yet. You see, Monsanto maintains a program within the company that, upon request, sees the company come to a farm and clean up the damages that their plants may inflict upon other farmers. When such unwanted plants begin to grow on a farm, they're referred to as volunteers, and it's the willingness of the company to literally come and pick out the plants by hand that seems to suggest that Monsanto is trying to protect itself from any legal avenues that farmers may choose to take. Now, as you can imagine, a company like Monsanto would not be so keen to employ an army of people to go to farms and pick out plants with their own hands. It certainly isn't the so-called modern technology that such a company tries to promote. So while they insist that they're happy to help farmers, some farmers aren't so happy with the way the company deals with such issues. One of these farmers was Robert Stevenson, a Manitoba farmer who in 2001 found these volunteer canola plants growing in his fields, which he said in an interview with the Western Producer were, quote, thick enough to produce a crop, end quote. Now, the problem most farmers have with such unwanted crops is that they don't easily die with chemical pesticides. Monsanto did financially compensate Stevenson for his efforts to rid his farm of the plants. However, Stevenson believes the process to not be farmer-friendly. In that same interview, he called the program, quote, unrealistic, and that the program is on a field-by-field basis, and who has time to argue on every field. He further added that the company also comes out to the farm and, quote, questions the farmer's farm management practices, and they question your ability to keep your seed clean, end quote. He further added that it's, quote, a very confrontational approach. Then they say they'd like to assist you, end quote. And this is Deconstructing Dinner. With such a heated history between Percy Schmeiser and Monsanto, I did ask Percy if he believed that he was treated any differently than any other farmer in such a case.
They sent some more letters back, and they said, we treat all farmers the same. And they said they're not going to make an exception for anybody. So that told me right away, this is what they were getting farmers to do, sign gag orders. So then they could say, well, there's just a few cases. We don't know how many hundreds of cases there have been, but that's how they maintain their secrecy.
Now, if the seeming fear by the company isn't evident in the way they operate their unexpected canola volunteer program, perhaps a letter the company sent to Percy following his refusal to sign their release form will better suggest that the company is getting worried.
Monsanto's lawyer, back when they refused to remove the plants unless I signed the gag order, they also wrote me a letter and said, we wish to remind you that that is our property that is on your land, and you're not free to use it or do whatever you want with it. It's our property. Then they also said in that same letter, we would advise you that it would be in the best interest for you not to seed canola or mustard into that land next year, which would have been 2006, because of the contamination of their GMO canola. So now I'm even told, and I told them, now you're even telling me that what I can seed next year and what I cannot seed, and I said, we own that land. We pay the taxes on the land, and now you want to take ownership in regards to what we can or cannot grow in it. You know, they're telling farmers now what you can grow, cannot control, grow, because they have contaminated you, and they want to dictate the orders. I said, you people have done the damage to me. I dictate to you what I want done, not you, because you've done the damage.
As has been done in the past here on Deconstructing Dinner, when it comes to this topic of genetic modification and farmers' rights, it's always important to look at the media coverage that surrounds these stories. There was very little mention of this case leading up to the March 19th court date, and sure enough, only one representative of the media was there at the courthouse, and that was Don Cossack, whom I spoke with prior to the date to ensure that someone would be on hand to interview Percy in this morally precedent-setting case. Don is the host of Making the Links Radio, a weekly show based at CFCR Saskatoon, an independent community station. And bringing you this exclusive interview, here's Don Cossack speaking with a very happy Percy Schmeiser as he walked out of the Saskatoon courthouse.
Percy, this is a momentous day. Can you tell us what's happened? Because a lot of people are waiting to hear. They know that you've gone to small claims court, and they're really interested in knowing what happened.
Well, what happened today is that Monsanto settled out of court on the issues that were very important to me, that first of all, I could maintain my freedom of speech, I could the terms of settlement, and also that if I was contaminated in the future on that same field, I could take them to court also. So that, to me, was a great victory now that they're settling my claim, my lawsuit against them out of court.
What does this mean for farmers in North America or anywhere where they're having to deal with Monsanto GMO products?
Well, I think to some degree it sets a precedent. I don't know at this time how much. I think every case could be different. But in my case, I always maintain that a farmer should never give up his rights to his freedom of speech. And a farmer, if he's contaminated, should have the legal recourse to have damages paid to him or to clean up.
How do you view this in terms of you've been locked in a struggle with Monsanto over many years, so how do you view this day today?
Well, I really feel delighted, and I think for my family, the pressure that has been on us and fighting a multinational corporation, and now it has come almost full circle that the shoe was on the other foot, and they settled with us now.
And how do you think other farmers should be organizing themselves? Clearly, you're one person who took on the behemoth, but how should other farmers be dealing with this issue?
I really believe that farmers should go together, stand together, and maintain their freedom of speech, the freedom that they always can use their own seed, and also to continue fighting that patents should never be put on life. Life is sacred, and no one should have the right to control life. And in my case, where my fields were contaminated, they are now paying for the damage to clean it up.
You've had a long walk, and your wife has been a real partner to you, but how have you managed to maintain the energy to keep going to get to a day like today?
I think it was, I not only had my family support, but I think I often say I had a world army of people supporting me for the rights of people, and I think that's what kept us going, is to maintain and to give me energy. And when I hear and I see how people have been controlled, especially in third world nations, how their rights are taken away in regards to use of their own seed, and I think seeing that has really given us the incentive, because we still had the chance here in our country to stand up and fight for our rights.
Do you think the decision today, what you want today, will give more energy then to the organic farm movement, to people who are really trying to preserve and control their seed production and seed use?
I think very much so, because they were contaminated the same as I was. And I'm sure that if I was successful and my wife was successful, they can also be now successful and are reimbursed on the economic issue and the loss of biodiversity and also the rights of organic farmers not being able to grow the crops that they so desire to grow. So I think it's a real important issue that organic should give an incentive to the organic farmers to take a stand now and go the same way as I did to stand up on the liability issue. And this is what it's all about, liability.
So I'm going to, can you give a good, this will be going on radio and it'll be picked up many places. Can you give a message to both farmers and consumers and people who are trying to deal with having some kind of control over this, the food they produce?
Well, I think there's a number of issues here. First of all, the one that was most dear to our hearts, my wife and myself, was that there never should be patents on life, and life should not become a commodity where it's bought and sold. That's number one. And the rights of farmers always should be maintained to use your own seeds leaves and plants if they so desire. That right should never, ever be taken away, because if that right is taken away from a farmer, then we'll be back to a feudal system and we'll just become serfs of the land. So farmers have to stand up. Consumers have to stand up for their rights to know what's in their food, what they're eating, what they're feeding to their children and to their grandchildren. I think it's a fundamental, basic violation of human rights in Canada when we do not know what's in our food. And all of us should have that right. It's a violation of human rights when farmers cannot use their seed grown on their land from year to year. So I think there's a lot more to this than just the patents of seeds and plants. It's all about human rights in Canada.
You've been an apostle in a way to take this issue on, and you've gotten a lot of support around the world in Europe, and you've traveled through Africa and many places. So will this have resonance there as well?
I believe it would, because it'll give encouragement that there is light at the end of the tunnel, that you can stand up to a multi-billion dollar corporation in court, and that there is justice.
Thank you, Percy Schmeiser.
Thank you very much.
And this is Deconstructing Dinner, and that was Saskatchewan farmer Percy Schmeiser interviewed immediately after an out-of-court settlement with Monsanto at a Saskatoon courthouse on March 19, 2008. Interviewing Percy was Don Kosick of Making the Links Radio, which airs weekly at CFCR Saskatoon. Now, it only took a few hours before Monsanto issued a press release to address the outcomes of the settlement. After the press release was issued by Monsanto's Trish Jordan, I engaged in an ongoing dialogue with her over email and telephone to clarify items stated in that release that did not correspond with what we just heard Schmeiser say unfolded since 2005. Now, it is important to note that there were a few mentions in Canadian media about this case, including the Globe and Mail and Saskatoon Star Phoenix, and in both cases, they simply quoted Trish Jordan from the press release itself. Now, I mention this because clearly, following my dialogue with Jordan, there are some highly questionable statements made in that release. First off, I will say that Jordan expressed a very clear frustration with my ongoing questions over email, and when we finally decided to pick up the phone and talk about it, I insisted that she understand that my ongoing questioning is because Monsanto's story and Schmeiser's stories were completely different, and that as a journalist I want to report both sides of the story in this particular case. And her response was this, quote, "Both sides of the story don't need to be presented," end quote. But jumping back to the press release issued by the company, the paragraph in question read this, "Although we are pleased Mr. Schmeiser finally approached us and agreed to settlement terms, it is frustrating that he essentially accepted the same offer we put before him in 2005," end quote. This is the statement that made its way into both the Globe and Mail and the Star Phoenix. But according to Schmeiser, and as we just heard him explain, the initial release form that Monsanto asked him to sign was significantly different than the one agreed upon this week, and for two critical reasons. The first is in reference to the confidentiality clause. Schmeiser had refused to sign the initial release because he didn't want to sign away his right to freedom of speech. The second issue that encouraged Percy to not sign the release form was that located within the standard release that the company issued to him was a clause that would have required Percy to agree that they never bring the company to court for any future contamination of their farm. Now, because of timing, I wasn't able to verify the legal wording of this document, but you can expect more on this on next week's show when we will determine if that release form did indeed suggest this. Because if it did, then clearly the statement in Monsanto's press release is even more misleading than it already seems. Regardless, in the settlement reached on March 19th, 2008, Percy will be allowed to challenge the company in the future for any further contamination of his farm. Seeking clarification on this, I contacted the author of the release, Trish Jordan, who is Monsanto Canada's Public Affairs Director. And now I'll first state that this response will be posted word for word on the Deconstructing Dinner website. But of interest was at the beginning of her response, where she wrote, quote, "Not sure what the point in debating this is," and it continues, "We had previously offered to amend the release to something that would be suitable for Mr. Schmeiser in 2005 and again at a mediated case management hearing over a year ago. He again refused at that time and said he would never sign a release. Our offer was always open to rework our standard release," end quote. I called up Schmeiser and asked if this was true, and he was deeply upset to hear this statement because, as he says, the company never made any effort to change the release to his liking. And so I followed up with Trish Jordan over the phone to ask her to expand on their so-called offer in 2005 to revise the release form, and she said that there was never any discussion. A marked difference to her original email. Now, to conclude my phone conversation with Jordan, I did ask how the initial form and the one settled on March 19th were any way close to being the same. And she responded by denying that any similarities were ever implied, and told me in a rather aggravated way, "Why don't you read my press release?" End quote. Well, here's Jordan's press release again. And it says this: he essentially accepted the same offer we put before him in 2005. End quote. And you can read this release on Monsanto's website at monsanto.ca. And you can expect more on this story on future broadcasts because while the case does not set a legal precedent, it became clear to me that Monsanto is very worried about what the exposure of this case will do to the company. It's now clear that farmers across North America can challenge one of the most influential multinational companies in the world and insist that they pay for the damages caused by the company's products, or at the very least, insist that the company clean up the damages and not require the farmers to restrict their right to take legal action or to speak about the terms to others. And you can stay tuned for that.
We hope that you're finding today's broadcast of Deconstructing Dinner a valuable resource of information. This program is distributed weekly, free of charge, and relies on the financial support from you, the listener. Should you wish to ensure a perpetual harvest of Deconstructing Dinner, we kindly ask for your financial support through our website at cjly.net/deconstructingdinner or by dialing 250-352-9600.
And this is Deconstructing Dinner, a weekly one-hour radio show and podcast produced at Kootenai Co-op Radio in Nelson, British Columbia. This show is heard on radio stations around the world and is available as a podcast. My name is John Steinman. Today's show is archived on our website at cjly.net/deconstructingdinner and is titled Water, the Blood of the Earth, and Monsanto Pays Percy Schmeiser. For the remainder of today's broadcast, we will visit with another recipient to the Right Livelihood Award, and that is Maude Barlow. Barlow is the national chairperson for the Council of Canadians, Canada's largest citizens organization with members and chapters across the country. The council works to protect Canadian independence by promoting progressive policies on fair trade, clean water, energy security, public health care, and other issues of social and economic concern to Canadians. Maude Barlow is the co-founder of the Blue Planet Project, which has been working internationally to advocate the human right to water. It has been a failing of Deconstructing Dinner to not cover water issues as in-depth as they deserve, and today's foray into the world of water will mark the beginning of a much more concentrated effort into the many issues facing the global supply of water. Barlow insists that water is the greatest ecological and human rights crisis of our time, and certainly water is absolutely fundamental to our food and to life itself. In March 2008, Maude Barlow spoke in Castlegar, British Columbia, to a sold-out audience of approximately 900 people, a staggering turnout given the population of Castlegar and neighboring Nelson is around 20,000 people. I was in attendance to record Maude speak, and we'll hear segments from her talk in just a moment, but I first want to share with you the significance of the location in which she spoke. The event took place at the Brilliant Cultural Center. Brilliant is the area in which the center is located. Now, it's the very land on which the center is built that was the location of a community of the original inhabitants of the area, the Senaiaxt people, also known as the Lakes people. The last known Senaiaxt resident of the land was Alex Christian, who in 1914 pleaded unsuccessfully to the Royal Commission on Indian Affairs to be allowed to remain on the land. And he said this to the commission: "I wish to state that I was born there and have made that place my headquarters during my entire life. Also, my ancestors have belonged to that place as far back as I can trace. Both of my parents were born there and three of my grandparents. I want to stay in the home where I have always been and want to have a piece of land made secure for me. I also ask that the graveyards of my people be fenced and preserved from desecration." End quote. It was only years later that Christian was murdered while trying to protect his home, and no one was ever brought to justice, and archaeological evidence on the site does indeed date back 5,000 years. But the reason why the area was such an ideal place for the Senaiaxt was that it was situated on the forks of the Kootenai River and Arrow Lakes, both of which are part of the Columbia River system. Before the construction of the Grand Coulee Dam in 1933, the river system thrived with salmon that would swim all the way up into the interior of British Columbia from the Pacific Ocean. This was a primary food source of native communities up and down the river system, and the construction of the dam marked the end to this way of life and contributed to the end of many of these communities themselves. It's also interesting to note that there also was a time when white sturgeon could be fished out of the Kootenai River not far from the Brilliant Cultural Center, with some fish having been over 10 feet in length and weighing up to 750 pounds. The Columbia River system today represents the largest hydroelectric system in the world, but also represents one of the most environmentally and socially destructive projects to ever have been constructed in North America. Making up part of this system that contributed to the demise of the region's indigenous populations was the Brilliant Dam, just steps away from where Maud Barlow was speaking. The dam was constructed in 1944. When first addressing the audience in March of 2008 at the Brilliant Cultural Center, Maud referred to the significance of the site on which her talk on water issues was taking place. She first spoke of the absolute irresponsible managing of water by the Western world.
Please give a welcome to Maud Barlow.
Thank you very, very, very much for your gorgeous welcome here tonight. I cannot believe how many of you have come out tonight to this fabulous hall. It's my second time to be honored to speak in this beautiful hall and Brilliant, and I just feel that we're here in the most important place, steeped in history and challenged by the social justice ghosts in this room. I'm just thrilled to be here. I've actually been in the United States a fair bit in the last month and a half. This book, Blue Covenant, came out here in Canada in the fall. I did a pretty extensive tour, and now I'm in the belly of the beast, touring in Washington and New York and Boston and Miami and through California and you name it. So I'm very filled with these stories of a superpower to the south of us, let me tell you, that is going dry in some very important places. A recent Environmental Protection Agency report said that there are now 36 states in the United States that are going to have, and I quote, from severe to serious to severe water crises in the next 5 to 10 years. There are 7 states actually facing water, the end of water kind of right now, Colorado and Utah and California, New Mexico and Arizona. But in Arizona, they just announced that they're building a water theme park in the desert called the Water Wave. And they're going to have waves so high that you can surf on them, and they're going to have rivers that run so fast that they're going to have whitewater rafting on this place in the desert. It reminds me of the Far Side cartoon where there's a bunch of dogs in a life raft, and their ship is sinking, so that's why they're in this life raft. And one of them says, okay, everybody who wants to eat all the food at once, put your hands up, right? It's like, okay, we have 10 years left of water. Maybe if we build a water theme park, we can knock that down to 5, you know? I was in Utah for the Sundance Film Festival, because there's a film, a lovely film, that I'm urging everyone to see when it's available, called Flow for Love of Water, which I'm in quite a bit, so they asked me to come to Utah for this wonderful Sundance Film Festival. And, you know, I just wandered around in awe. This is a state that totally, completely depends on the snowmelt from the mountains, and they are cutting down the trees and the shrubs that protect that snow so fast, it kind of reminded me of the dogs in the life raft. And they're building new ski runs, and they're building these great big resorts, and they're building in the summer these all-terrain vehicle trails, so they're just cutting everything down. And I was telling folks today that I stayed in one of these tacky little condos. They're putting thousands of them up, just kind of boxes on top of each other, and there was no sort of awareness of water, no notes about it, no, you know, please save our water. The shower in my condo had two speeds off and hurt, like it went so fast it kind of hurt. And I thought, this is the problem that we are facing. It's not that we don't have enough water in the world. It is that we are, particularly we in the global west, global north, have taken water for granted. We have what I call a myth of abundance, and we just have have used water terribly, but in the United States, it's a crisis. And let me tell you, the American government, for the first time in the last 2 years, is finally beginning to see that this is a problem. The Colorado is, and I quote, in catastrophic decline. When I was in California 2 weeks ago, a study came out that said that Lake Mead and Lake Powell, which are the big backup reservoirs, for Las Vegas, for Nevada, for so many of the communities there, may be actually empty within 10 to 13 years. Now you can imagine what we're dealing with. It's like all of California waking up the way Atlanta did one day a few months ago and finding out that you're out of water.
You're listening to Maude Barlow of the Council of Canadians speaking in March 2008 in Castlegar, British Columbia. Our food system here in Canada is currently very dependent on the supply of water in California. Looking at statistics from a few years ago, of the $20 billion in food that is imported into Canada each year, a little over 4% of that value comes from the state of California alone. That's $835 million. I imagine I don't speak for myself when I say that I would cringe at the idea of exporting water to California so that they could grow food to then ship back to Canada. But when we hear of the absolute absurdity of building water parks in Arizona and housing developments in the middle of the desert, I think it would be foolish to think that the United States would be incapable of orchestrating such a scenario. Such a prospect leads Maude Barlow to caution Canadians. However, she does remain hopeful.
And I just want to just kind of start off with this caution for Canadians, because I do believe that there's going to come a time in the not too distant future when we're going to be looked to for that water. But I want to start off really with just a description of the international situation, or the global crisis, or the Earth's crisis around water. And I want to say, first of all, that I'm actually very hopeful. I'm going to give you some tough statistics tonight, and I'm going to tell you a tough story, but then I'm going to tell you that we have all the knowledge that we need in terms of fixing this. All we have to do is be sensible and conserve and protect source water and bring back water into watersheds that are no longer able to retain water because we have abused it. We know all the things we have to do. What we're lacking is political will, and we're going to have to find that, and I don't think it's going to come from the top. I think it's going to come from the bottom, from communities like this, from young people, from poor people, from farmers, from peasants and indigenous communities. It's going to come up off the ground, because that's where this movement is going. But just to situate it globally, in my opinion, the global water crisis is the greatest ecological and human rights crisis of our time. And I'm not competing with climate change. I think this is the face of climate change. It's the first and most devastating face of climate change. There are close to 2 billion people in the world who are living in areas that do not have enough water. And the numbers are getting worse, not better. By the year 2025, two-thirds of the world's population will be living with some level of scarcity. Again, some that you could manage, some where people are going to die in increasing numbers. In Africa alone, 1 in 3 people now are living without adequate access to water. In 10 years, that'll be 1 in 2. So you can see that we're going in entirely the wrong direction. And the lack of water is perhaps the most profound and visual signal of the inequality between rich and poor in our world. And it is the first face of this kind of deep poverty, this kind of economic apartheid that we have created in this world. More children die every day of waterborne disease than of HIV/AIDS, traffic accidents, war, and malaria all put together. It's the number one killer. Half the hospital beds in the world are filled with people who would not be there if they could afford clean water. So it literally is an issue of life and death for people around the world. And I won't forget, it's many years now, but since the first time I was in a very poor community and understood that a bucket of water had to do for the whole family, for washing, for cooking, for cleaning the clothes, and came home to my house, which is a modest home, I'm not a rich person, and counted, I think, 6 different places where I could turn the water off or turn the water on if you include the hose out front and back, and the kitchen and the laundry room and 2 bathrooms and so on, and realized that we take water so for granted, and in most of the world that's no longer possible, but it's increasingly not going to be possible here. And this is the true meaning behind William Grider's wonderful title of his book, One World, Ready or Not.
Now, while the many concerns facing the global supply of water would very easily be passed off as one face of climate change, Maude Barlow does believe that how we manage our water is very much a cause of climate change. In one case, she refers to surface water pollution, which in the case of food is very much a result of poor agricultural practices, most often through the industrial systems dominating our food supply.
And I am trying with the book and with my work and with some scientists I'm working with to introduce the notion that water is not just a result or a victim of greenhouse gas-induced climate change, but actually one of the causes. And here's how it goes, very briefly. We are polluting surface water so extensively around the world that in many, many, many countries and communities, people cannot use that water anymore to live, to cook, to even, you know, to drink for sure, but even to water their vegetables and their crops and their animals. So what happens is that we have started to take water from where nature put it to serve ourselves. And in doing so, we've interrupted the hydrologic cycle. Now, you'll all remember, around grade 6, you learned about the hydrologic cycle, and you learned that the water cycle is finite, and it can't go anywhere, and it goes round and round in this loop of being evaporated, coming back down as rain or snow or whatever. But actually, our teachers weren't lying to us, but they didn't know that we would be capable of such massive displacement of those resources, that water resource, that we're actually interrupting the hydrologic cycle itself. And we're now creating less water, where the hydrologic cycle is now producing less water in parts of the world that used to have it, because we're creating desert as we move water away from where it was put. We're massively, massively pumping groundwater. In India alone, there are 23 million bore wells going 24/7. A group of scientists in the UK last year said there is coming anarchy in India over this exponential overpumping, because what may seem limitless, of course, is not. And so one night you go to bed in this valley or this community and there's water, and the next morning you wake up and it's all gone. Around the Great Lakes, there are bore wells going deep into the springs that feed the Great Lakes that go as deep into the ground as the Chicago skyscrapers go into the sky. And they're pumping the water so hard that last year, for the first time, they reversed the flow of water in Lake Michigan. And they're now drinking in Lake Michigan water, which is one of the reasons, of course, that the lakes are declining.
As mentioned earlier, water will become more of an ongoing focus here on Deconstructing Dinner as this show evolves, and one topic to narrow in on is what is known as virtual water. While Canadians may feel assured that our water is not yet being exported in bulk quantities, when paying closer attention, it is. Whether it be the water fed to the cattle that get exported, or the water used to grow grains or fruit for export, or perhaps the water used to wash the floors of the industrial hog factories producing the pork that gets shipped off to the many eager Asian markets. Canada ships away this virtual water every day, and Maud Barlow explains.
We're also doing something called virtual water trade. You're going to hear a lot more about this in the next few years. Virtual water trade is the water that's embedded in something you export, so what you needed to grow a commodity or crop or to produce something that you then export. And we haven't been taking it into account, but it turns out that about almost a quarter of all the water in the world every single day is exported out of a watershed or out of a country in the form of virtual water, very often to satisfy the needs of great big transnational corporations, whether they're bottling companies, whether they're big agribusiness companies, who come in and use this water and then ship it away. I was in the Lake Naivasha in Kenya just about a year ago now, and we've launched a campaign to save this lake. And this is the most exquisite lake in the Rift Valley in Kenya, the home of the last wild hippopotamus herd in East Africa. And we were out on this gorgeous lake, and we saw flamingos and pelicans and the hippopotamus in the water, and they're mean creatures. You don't want to get too close to them. They hiss at you and they kind of peer at you like they'd like to eat you, which they would. And I looked at this island with zebra and wildebeest and so on, and I said to the boatman, God, it looks just like where Out of Africa was filmed. And he said, well, that would be because that's where Out of Africa was filmed, right on that island, right? Exquisite beyond language, but the lake's dying, and it's dying with this virtual water trade, because the rose companies, rose as in flowers, big agribusiness rose corporations from Europe, which don't want to use up water in Europe because they're running out too, are surrounding lakes like Lake Naivasha using their water to grow roses, which they then export to Great Britain, Holland, and so on, the places that used to grow those gorgeous roses. And the lake is dying. The lake will be, and I quote, a putrid puddle in 5 to 10 years, quote, quoting one group of scientists. And the hippopotamus herd is literally baking to death in the sun. I mean, this is just one example of the abuse of water in one country to service the needs of the water footprint in another country. And in North America, we're huge water exporters. We don't call it that because it's this embedded water. We're going to have to know a lot more about it.
And this is Deconstructing Dinner. We're listening to segments of a talk given in March 2008 in Castlegar, British Columbia, by the Council of Canadians, Maude Barlow. Deconstructing Dinner recorded the event. Now, one focus on water that this program has tackled on past shows has been bottled water. This, too, will be the topic yet again for an upcoming show, and Maude Barlow was rather direct in what she considers bottled water to represent, and that is our collective insanity.
Last year, we put something like 200 billion liters of water in plastic bottles around the world. About 95% of that is not recycled, so it goes into our watersheds and into great big mountains of garbage. It's a form of collective insanity to take a precious gift like water that flows and encapsulate it in plastic and create mountains of garbage and fossil fuel emissions making this stuff. It is a form of insanity. But the fastest growing area of corporate control of water, which interested me and which I really learned about as I was writing the book, is new technologies. And I want to tell you about this because I think it's very important for us to understand. Because we in the global north have this hubris that we are above nature, instead of fitting into nature, we're designing technology to conquer nature, and now we're doing it with water. So the American government in particular is putting billions and billions and billions of dollars into desalination plants, which are polluting, intensively fossil fuel using. Now they're talking about nuclear power desal. There is a tripling of desalination plants planned for the world in the next 10 years, 25 to 30 on the California coast alone. A terrible technology, a technology that really says we've tried everything else, when that is not true. It's a sign of failure. Nanotechnology, which is totally deregulated, which is the workings of the molecule, our playing with the molecules of life, the molecular structures of life. Toilet to tap recycling, literally toilet to tap. I'm working with friends in Australia who've got a group called CAD, Citizens Against Drinking Sewage. Well, their best water is being used to ship, well, to make all the wine that everybody loves and all the stuff that goes around the world. They're being told they have to drink sewage water. But the biggest companies in the world, General Electric, Dow Chemical, they're all getting into water recycling. And I'm of course, water recycling is a piece of the answer. But my concern is that I can see these corporations moving in to take control of the process, owning the water they recycle, and then being able to say, well, this is what we're going to charge for it. And if you think the problem for not having access to water is only in the global south, wrong. In Detroit 3 years ago, the Water Authority cut off water to 82,000 families, 42,000 families in that city, and then sent Social Security in to take the kids away because there was no water for the children. So it's not just going to be an issue of the global south. As water becomes more and more and more expensive and more corporately controlled, it is going to become an issue of equity in the so-called first world. Because guess what? We have a third world here too. And they're going to be hit dramatically when we start to put this corporate for-profit price on water.
Maude Barlow has long been fighting to wake Canadians up to the siphoning off of our natural resources by the hungry appetite to the south. And she does have a number of suggestions as to what Canada needs to do to protect our water now and into the future.
And I think that we should be very nervous in this country, frankly, about a country that is A, a superpower, B, running out of water, C, has an agreement called NAFTA with us in which water is both a tradable good and an investment, and D, that is not curbing its water wastage whatsoever. The U.S. is by far the biggest water waster in the world. So we have some things to think about in this country. We have no national water legislation to protect our source water, to protect drinking water standards. We have no idea where our groundwater is. We keep being told we have 20% of the world's fresh water. That's nonsense. You'd have to drain every lake and river in the country to have access to that. We have about 6.5% of the available fresh water. But most of that water isn't ours either. And I keep saying this to my American friends. It's in mighty rivers running north in the north. And to get at it, either for those of us living in the south of Canada or in the United States, we'd have to reverse the flow of that water and send it through great big pipelines, probably fueled by nuclear power, and send it down to the United States. It would go to Las Vegas, it would go to California, it would go to Nevada, it would go to those developments. It would go to GE, it would go to Dow Chemical, the nice folks who brought us Bhopal and now want to clean up our water. It would not go to the children who are so desperately needing it. So it's not a case of not sharing. We have water in ecosystems and watersheds that need to be there to protect the ecosystem health of that region. And we all have to adapt our ways to live within the water reality that we've been allocated, and we're going to have to change our ways of living. Oh, I just want to say one thing before I say that. I do want to mention the Security and Prosperity Partnership for North America. Though it's very hard getting this subject even raised south of the border, although we've got a coalition of groups now beginning to work with us. Security and Prosperity Partnership is a deal that was signed in Waco, Texas in March of 2005 between the heads of the three governments of North America, literally the prime ministers and presidents, and basically it was an initiative of the big business community in Canada that was worried that with the post 9/11 fear of terrorism in the United States, the border would thicken. This is the term they use. So they proposed the Security and Prosperity Partnership to the Martin government, who jumped on it, proposed it to the Americans, and away we all went. And basically, Canada and Mexico have agreed to adopt U.S. security measures, the war on terror, including merging our no-fly lists and all sorts of things. We're in Afghanistan, so the U.S. can be in Iraq and so on. We agreed to do that in exchange for keeping this border open, which hasn't particularly happened. So it's you know, we haven't even got that from it. And there are 21 working groups right across the board harmonizing every single area of life in North America down to the lowest standards, from food safety and pesticides and environmental rules and so on. There's also a resource pact. And at first they just talked about energy, but last May I got in a brown paper bag the agenda for an upcoming closed-door meeting in Calgary, which basically was going to discuss Canada's water. And it said very clearly that Canada has 20% of the world's water and the United States is in trouble, and that we would have to start thinking about Canada's water the way we now see Canada's energy, which is that it's not Canada's energy, it's North American energy. And when we gave this to the media, everybody backed down. The Canadian delegation turned around at the airport and got on a plane and went back, did not go to the meeting. But that does not mean that the story's over. And we need in this country not only legislation to protect our groundwater, map our groundwater, set environmental standards, bring the rule of law, to protect our water sources. We need to have a ban on the commercial export of water, and we need to say yes to Hillary and Obama when they introduce the concept of reopening NAFTA and take water out. And you should know that water is also an investment under NAFTA, which means that the big American energy companies operating in the Alberta tar sands would have the right to sue all Canadians for billions of dollars of compensation if the government of Alberta at any point said, you've got to stop destroying our water table, you've got to conserve, you've got to use gray water, we're going to limit the water. They could say, this is a change of the rules, which under NAFTA, your companies have to live with, but we don't. And that's called Chapter 11 of NAFTA. It's the clause that gives corporations of one country the right to sue a government of another NAFTA country if it changes the rules, even for environmental reasons or health and safety reasons.
and this is Deconstructing Dinner. In closing out today's broadcast, I'll leave you with this final segment of Maude Barlow's talk, in which she introduces her Blue Covenant, the title of her most recent book.
And so I'm calling for what I call a blue covenant with the earth, to say to our Mother Earth, you gave us life, you protected us. This water that you gave us is the lifeblood of the earth. And if we destroy the lifeblood of the earth, it's like destroying the blood in our veins. It's a form of suicide. This notion of unlimited growth, this notion that we can keep exporting and keep trading and keep being competitive, and this market-based capitalism driving everything is fundamentally wrong. And the earth has hit its limits. It has hit its carrying capacity. It can't do it anymore. And it is telling us that it has to stop and that we have to stop. As one American environmentalist said, unlimited growth has the same ideology as the cancer cell. It has to turn on its host in order to survive, and that's what's happening now. We are killing the earth in order to continue to have this notion that there's no limit to what we can have. And we need a blue covenant between rich and poor, not to charity, right? And it's fine to go dig wells in Africa, but that's not the answer in the end. We need an international system based on justice and based on solidarity. And based on the reality that everyone in the world has a fundamental right to water, and that no one has the right to abrogate it for private profit while other people are dying because they cannot pay, and only because they cannot pay. This absolutely has to change, and it won't change until we deal with the incredibly unfair situation of the debt of the global south to the global north, in which they send more money north in debt relief every year than we send in aid and trade together. Until we deal with that fundamental reality, poor countries in the global south will have no ability to provide clean water or health care or education for their people. And finally, we're calling for a blue covenant to declare water to be a fundamental right, a right of people, a right of other species, a right of the earth. We have to protect water for the earth, and if you hand it over to private companies, who's going to do that? We're fighting for a right to water covenant at the UN. You will be unhappy but not surprised, perhaps, to know that Canada has not been supporting this measure, nor has the U.S., but we're going to keep fighting. We have a group called the Canadian Friends of the Right to Water, and we aren't going to give up, but I know perfectly well that our government knows that it's pretty hard to say water's a human right over here when you've said that it's a tradable good in NAFTA. And that conflict is something they're extremely well aware of, whether they're willing to admit it or not. We need to say that water does not belong to anyone. It belongs to the earth. It belongs to all species. It belongs to future generations. It is a public trust. It is part of our global commons, and we have to fiercely protect it.
And that was Maude Barlow speaking in March 2008 in Castlegar, British Columbia. Maude is the national chairperson of the Council of Canadians and the co-founder of the Blue Planet Project. And you can learn more about the project by visiting blueplanetproject.net. And you can expect to hear more on this all-important topic of water on future broadcasts of Deconstructing Dinner. Our negligent and irresponsible managing of water over the past century is an incredible window into how disconnected we have all become from not only our surroundings, but from ourselves. Poet and essayist Wendell Berry perhaps said it best. If there is any truth to the cliché, you are what you eat, then we should be honest about the fact that most of us do not have the slightest idea what we are. That was this week's edition of Deconstructing Dinner, produced and recorded at Nelson, British Columbia's Kootenai Co-op Radio. I've been your host, John Steinman. I thank my technical assistant, John Ryan. The theme music for Deconstructing Dinner is courtesy of Nelson area resident Adam Shake. This radio program is provided free of charge to campus community radio stations across the country and relies on the financial support from you, the listener. Support for the program can be donated through our website at cjly.net/deconstructingdinner or by dialing 250-352-9600.